no resentment underneath. I'll extend the laurel wreath and we'll just be friends. But right there is where it ends. I don't hold no grudge. I'll forgive you your mistakes, but please forgive me if I take it all to heart. And now let this thing start again. I'm the kind of individual you can step on for a while, but when I call it quits, baby, that's it. I'm the kind of person you might hurt once in a while, but crawling ain't my style. I don't hold no grudge.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this rainy Friday morning. It's 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and it's the 16th of October. We welcome you to the program and are very thankful that you were with us this morning. We so appreciate you taking the time out and joining us as we try to embrace what is happening in our world and, oh, God forbid, even try to make some sense of it. So let me introduce our panel. We first welcome you to the conversation, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. Another week has gone by. How are you?
It's unbelievable. Another week has gone by, and it's Friday. But in any case, Joe, I'm fuming. If you want to know how I really am, I'm fuming.
Fuming
about the idea that herd immunity has been embraced by a couple of people. We don't care about that. They can say whatever they want with initials after their names, fancy initials. But in fact, they called it the Great Barrington Declaration. And this has really got everybody in my little town furious. And not only that, guess who has adopted it? The White House has adopted it and is considering making it herd immunity official policy, which we know they've always been interested in. So I'm angry. I'm just angry. And I know my fellow residents in Great Barrington, for the most part, are furious. I know that the Board of Selectmen did the right thing and came out and refuted it. And that's just something worth noting.
All right. So noted. We are going to talk about herd immunity this morning as well. We welcome Judith Enck to the program. And it's always a pleasure to have Judith here, senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics and former EPA regional administrator. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
I'm good. And this is an awkward transition, but I want listeners in New York State to know that starting this Monday, your on plastic bags takes effect. So no more plastic bags at supermarkets and department stores starting Monday in New York.
Okay. Another update. Are you fuming about that too? No.
I'm happy about you're happy, that, but happy. It seems a little insignificant compared to herd immunity, but I wanted to get it in there. We all have our issues.
Indeed, indeed. Communications faculty member at SUNY New Paltz and RPI and former New York State Senator Terry Gibson joins us. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Great pleasure to have you here. Professor of Economics at Siena College in Loudonville, New York, Aaron Pasitti. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning, everyone. Doing well. I love mornings like this morning, so doing even better.
Meaning rainy? Or mornings that you spend with us?
Oh, yeah. Rainy, gray, misty.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, got
whole,
it.
The whole package.
We also welcome back our friend, Dr. Jim Fagan. He is an immunologist. He specializes in in pediatric immunology and has been with us over these last couple of weeks as we, in the beginning, we're trying to get a handle on the president and his health. And today we'll be talking to him about these overall ideas of herd immunity and masks, which were questioned at last night's dueling town halls. And we're going to talk about that this morning. Dr. Fagan, good morning. Welcome. Thank you for being with us for a short time this morning. I appreciate it.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let us begin with the town halls that took place last night. And they were dueling. A lot of people were very upset that they were head-to-head with one another. The Donald Trump town hall was on NBC, which took a lot of flack for having the event. I do have to say, though, that Savannah Guthrie, man, I will apologize. Yesterday, I questioned how great she would be in that, but I thought she did a phenomenal job. But one of the issues that came up and one of the questions that she asked the president was about herd immunity. And the president deflected the question. He went off and then took it as a he said the cure cannot be worse than the problem himself. And then he launched into attacks against Governor Whitmer of Michigan. You will remember who was recently the victim of a foiled kidnap plot. So there's that. And he, upon further questioning by Savannah Guthrie, it was brought up, who is telling you, who is leading this charge? And because no scientists say that this is a good idea, he said, no, Dr. Scott Atlas, who is overseeing now the White House effort, it appears, says that it's fine. Savannah Guthrie quickly pointed out that he is, yes, but he's not an expert in immunology or in infectious disease. He is an expert. He is a radiologist. So my first question for Dr. Fagan is, when you're in the hospital and there is an issue in regards to immunology, at what point do you call the radiologist?
Yeah. when I need some radiographic imaging.
So what do we make of this as a plan? I mean, the idea of it seems very frightening because we know from other countries that have done it using science have not been at all successful. Right. And we seem to be doing it without science, which is very concerning.
Well, let's first talk about what herd immunity actually is. So herd immunity occurs when a large portion of a community becomes immune to a specific disease, and that makes the spread of the disease from one person to another much less likely. And as a result, the whole community becomes protected, not just those who are immune, but even those who don't have an immunity, by virtue of the fact that the degree of infection has gone down considerably in the community. Now, in order for an infection to spread through a community, a percentage of the population must be capable of getting the disease. And this is called the threshold proportion. So if the proportion of the population that is immune to the disease is greater than this threshold proportion, then the spread of the disease will decline. And this is a basic concept of herd immunity. But the question is, what percentage of a community actually needs to be immune in order to achieve herd immunity? And that varies from disease to disease. It's not one number. And what we know is that the more contagious a disease is, a greater proportion of the population will need to be immune to that disease in order to stop its spread. There are only two ways to create herd immunity. And one is to vaccinate a large proportion of the population. And vaccines have been enormously successful controlling very deadly contagious diseases such as smallpox, polio, diphtheria, measles, mumps, rubella, whooping cough, hepatitis. Just enormously successful in eradicating these very deadly infections. But one of the problems with vaccination is that for some vaccines, not all of them, but for some vaccines, the protection can wane over time because the immune response can decrease over a period of time. In terms of a COVID-19 vaccine, you know, we're going to, first of all, we'll have to develop the vaccine, and the vaccine will have to be very safe, proven to be safe through clinical trials, and obviously very effective, and all of us are, you know, waiting for this vaccine to become available. It's very unlikely that's going to happen within the next couple of months, but we'll have to wait and see what happens. So then the only other way to achieve herd immunity would be through natural infection, to let everybody get the disease. Now, there are major problems, obviously, with that. And one of the problems is with herd immunity, is especially with COVID-19, is that we don't yet know how long the immune response is going to be to this infection. I personally think it probably will be long-lasting, but we don't know that for sure. And so that's one major issue, is if we do achieve herd immunity through natural infection, how long is that immunity going to last? But, you know, and we got to get into other issues with herd immunity. We know that the World Health Organization estimates that for COVID-19, about 70% of the population would need to be immune to COVID-19 in order to achieve herd immunity for this particular virus. We also know that the case fatality rate in the United States is estimated to be around 3%. Now, how do we determine that? That's if you take the total number of deaths from COVID-19 and you divide that by the total number of individuals who are infected with COVID-19, that's how you get the case fatality rate. And that's been estimated to be 3%. That's probably, that number is probably too high. And the reason I say that is because if you look at the denominator, which is the number of individuals infected, there are probably many more individuals infected in the United States than we know about, because we know 25-30% of individuals who are infected with COVID-19 are asymptomatic. They may not even know that they have an infection, so they're not getting tested. But in any case, the actual case fatality rate is probably closer to 1%. So what does that mean? So the population of the United States is, 328 million people.
Right.
So in order to achieve herd immunity in the United States, about 200 million people would need to be infected. And if you do the math, that's going to result in the death of around 2 million Americans. 2 million Americans. Now, what is that going to do? Obviously, there's going to be an enormous stress on the entire population. There's going to be enormous stress on the healthcare system. Our current hospitalization rate in the United States for COVID-19 is about 1%. So that means if you have 200 million people infected, we should expect about 2 million hospital admissions. And this number of hospital admissions would absolutely overwhelm the healthcare system in this country. And then you can talk about the cost of this. If the average cost, let's say, what's the average cost of a hospital admission for COVID-19? It varies. It could be anywhere from $20,000 to $50,000, $60,000. So let's say it's, just lowball it. Say it's $30,000. So if the average cost of a hospital admission for COVID-19 is $30,000, then the total hospital cost to achieve herd immunity in this country would be around $80 billion. Okay? Now, and of course, then you have to go back to the fact that, herd immunity will only work if people cannot get reinfected. And the overwhelming likelihood is that, as I mentioned before, that if you do develop COVID-19, you probably will develop a long-lasting immunity. But we don't know that for sure yet. Only time will tell. And in terms of reinfection, we are starting to see a couple of case reports of people who clearly were diagnosed with COVID-19 and then recovered, then had negative testing, and then a month or two later developed the infection again. And, you know, we have to look carefully at those individuals because some of those individuals may actually, you know, have a immune deficiency that renders them susceptible to get this infection again. But we have to look at the details of that. But, you know, there are obviously major, major, major problems in terms of the concept of herd immunity that would need to be considered.
Am I right, though, in my assumption of what I'm reading? Is it fair to say that the majority of the medical community feels that this would be a very dangerous way to go?
Well, I can speak for myself and all of my colleagues. Absolutely. It's just the concept of just letting people go out there and get infected and become immune. You know, Joe, it's the analogy I think of is, you know, think about a really hot summer day, you know, and you have thousands of people, you know, at the beach in the ocean, swimming in the ocean, trying to cool off. And all of a sudden, there's a report that someone might have spotted a shark in the vicinity. So what do you do? Do we allow people to stay in the water? And, you know, because after all, you figure what's the percentage? What are the odds of getting attacked by a shark? You know, there was a shark sighting. What are the odds of you getting attacked by the shark? Pretty slim. And even if the shark comes in and, you know, maybe, you know, if, you know, so one or two people lose a limb or a life, you still got thousands of people enjoying the, you know, the water. Or do you immediately evacuate the, you know, the water to save every single life is precious. And so
that's a great analogy. I mean, you're not going to like just say, okay, we're going to feed the little devil. You all sit out there, and whoever gets is part of the buffet. Well, sorry for you, but the rest of you, congratulations.
Well, but that's sort of what herd immunity is doing.
Right, exactly. Now we have to take a break, so I'm going to pause. And Alan, I know you want to get in too. Let me just take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk to our panel. Dr. Jim Fagan is with us, and he will continue to be. We welcome your letters on this. We're getting a lot of letters about herd immunity, and we will continue with that right after this short break.
Read all your ruthless words through these tears in my eyes. Calculated and truthless words they've written down here in my book of lies. Oh, how you promised.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pasitti, and Terry Gibson. Immunologist Jim Fagan joining us for a bit this morning, and we're thrilled to have his expertise on the program. Listening to the music of Betty Levitt for the new album Blackbirds, which is so awesome, and we'll be playing that music this morning. And it's all on our playlist, which is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. Alan, you were about to ask Dr. Fagan a question.
Well, actually, it is a question that is related to our politics, and that is that we know that Donald Trump wants to open up the economy because he sees that as one of the only ways that he can win. He likes to brag about the way that it was. It isn't that way now. So the expense would be to put, as Jim Fagan just put it, 2 million people at risk and bust our economic system. So I think we can't lose sight of the fact that Trump is willing to go for this herd immunity concept based on what? On opening up the economy, even though it's of great danger to the American people. And it was just a comment as much as a question.
Well, and it seems to be that's where this is headed, right? As far as the of the rationale behind it, right, Doctor? I mean, there doesn't seem to be much that there could be another rationale.
Look, all of us are very aware of how difficult life has become, you know, with the advent of COVID-19. I mean, the world has been turned upside down for all of us, you know, and my heart breaks for the kids who cannot attend school, you know, the kids who freshmen in college who can't go to their colleges and universities or doing online learning from home, all of the, you know, the terrible suffering that all of us have had to endure because of this virus. It's just awful. There's no question about that. But the flip side to that is, you know, are we willing to sacrifice the lives of millions of people in order to, you know, achieve this herd immunity? And I think I speak for certainly many people in the medical field to say, no, we're not. That's not an option. That is not an option. You know, the other thing with herd immunity is, you know, we have no ability to determine which individual is going to have a bad outcome with COVID-19. You know, we know that there are risk factors such as age, primary or secondary immune deficiencies, obesity, diabetes, that increase the likelihood of developing a serious COVID-19 infection. But the real problem is that individuals with no known risk factors can still develop a serious COVID-19 infection. Of the 216,000 deaths from COVID-19 in the United States, many of these people who died were relatively young adults with no obvious risk factors, you know? And that's what we're faced with. It isn't just go out there and, you know, so you'll get a flu-like illness, you'll be uncomfortable, you run a fever, you know, aches and pains and sneezing for a week or two, but then, you know, you'll develop an immunity to this and congratulations. You know, that would be wonderful. That would be great. But that's not reality. You know, and then there are the post-infectious complications, the multi-system inflammatory syndrome that can occur in both children and now we know in adults as well. So this is not a disease that you want to even talk about just getting natural herd immunity to.
Jeff. Now,
Doctor, I wanted to, Joe, one last question here. I saw an article, I believe it was in the Times, about blood types and that certain blood types were more amenable to the COVID than others. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I think I saw that also, but I think that we still need a lot more information. You know, genetics always plays a role in everything, And, you know, this is an area that will obviously need to be studied. There are individuals who tend to be more prone to get certain infections. And then there are individuals who seem not, even if they haven't had it before, who don't have an immune response, you know, seem to do okay, you know, and I think that we still have to learn a lot about that. And I think that's part of the sort of the genetic makeup.
Jeff writes to us and says, so let me get this straight. The people who railed against mask mandates are now advocating an infection mandate. Where are their outrage cries of freedom infringement now? Asks
Unbelievable.
Jeff.
Unbelievable.
We also got this from Karen, who says those who advocate for herd immunity say that the young and those without predisposing conditions should go about their lives and pick up COVID-19 and gain immunity while the vulnerable are protected. They have a plan for the immunity part, just open up all the remaining parts of social and business commerce. They have no plan for the protect the vulnerable part, though, other than a vague idea that those who are at risk should decide to stay home. But there is no plan for those who are living with families, none for delivering services and supplies, especially there is no plan, for example, the over 30 million who have diabetes. It's an unserious plan catering to businesses' interests who have always been comfortable with the deaths of tens of thousands from pollution and inequity. I am sure, Doctor, you agree with most of that.
Absolutely. I mean, there are millions of Americans who are elderly, have pre-existing risk factors, they live in multi-generational households. How are we going to sequester these individuals from the rest of society? How are we going to do that?
Any questions from our other panelists? Judith's usually good for one.
Well, I'm, you know, on one hand, we have to take this seriously. On the other hand, it is just mind-blowing that this, I think, is actually being embraced by the Trump administration. I think it's a combination of perhaps a definite strategy on their part, coupled with their sheer incompetence and their inability to organize anything. But you know, when you take a step back and think about what they are advancing, it's, you know, it's unethical, it's unworkable, it's going to gut the economy. And I did notice that, you know, when the president got COVID, he was raced to the hospital and got special treatment with experimental drugs and, you know, lied and said that this was going to be available to everyone who needs it. That's not the case at all. So, you know, if he's a big proponent of herd immunity, why did he handle his own illness the way that he did?
Mm. Jerry writes.
Can I jump in here?
Yes, of course. Go ahead, Aaron.
So Jim and Judith both mentioned the economy, and I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, to the extent that this is part of a very libertarian approach to managing the virus, that, you know, with herd immunity, I think it would do far more economic damage in terms of getting there than, a more sensible approach like mask wearing. Because, you know, obviously, if there's no approach, if people just go about their business and they contract the virus, that people that are healthy aren't going to want to go out and shop. They're not going to want to travel. They're not going to want to go out to eat. So, you know, the potential from an economic point of view in terms of the economy entering an extreme and prolonged recession, I think is far greater with the herd immunity approach than a sensible mask wearing approach.
So just to be clear, what you're saying is people will not want to join the herd.
Yeah, exactly. Right. People would become more insular and, you know, more atomized, not less, if this was the actual, you know, policy framework.
And remember, you're not going to get herd immunity if you wear masks.
True.
Right.
You know, right. So let's just talk in our few moments that we have left with you, Doctor. Let's talk about masks. The president has been, over the last day and a half, has been using a quote, a soundbite, if you will, of saying that 85% of people who wear masks get the virus. Obviously, that's not true, and it is. It comes from almost, from my understanding of it, and perhaps you can explain it better. But almost an anecdotal study that it doesn't really even have to do with mask wearing in particular. But again, it seems like a very dangerous thing to be telling people that 85% of the people who wear masks get the virus.
Yeah. So that. No, that's absolutely insane. I mean, I have no idea where he got that number. I mean, in order to study this the correct way, you would have to take a large number of individuals who stated that they never wore a mask, and then a large number of individuals who always wore a mask, and then determine what percentage of those two populations developed COVID-19. Wearing a mask does not give you 100% absolute protection. It significantly decreases the likelihood of your getting infected with COVID-19, but it's not 100%. You know, it's all the other things that we do. You know, pulling the mask down for a second. You're sneezing. You're wiping your nose. You're wiping your eyes. You know, the things we touch. You know, you open a door. You forget to use the hand sanitizer. All of those things play a role. It's not just wearing a mask. Oh, there is absolutely no question that mask wearing is a major prevention of you know, getting COVID-19. There is no question about that. So that number that Donald Trump quoted, 85%, is ridiculous. I don't know where he pulled that from, but it is absolutely incorrect.
But I know where he got it from. He got it from his behind.
Well, I mean, there is a study, but as I said, it's very questionable, and it's not about that in particular. And but we don't, you know, we don't need to spend a lot of time on it because it's just not, it is not correct. And even quoting the study isn't quoted correctly. If even study is the word of what this was,
Joe, it's as if the president is purposely trying to kill people. I mean, there's no other way to say this. I mean, sharing that false statistic, doing his super spreader rallies all over the country when people can't even gather for funerals or weddings, it is as if he is purposely trying to kill people.
Do you think he's a murderer?
Yes, I do. Absolutely do. I mean, it's a harsh thing to say, but I don't know how you reach any other conclusion when you look at the complete failure. ProPublica has a story up on intense political interference in the CDC, an agency that should have been out there doing their job. But 217,000 Americans have died due to COVID. I'm not saying all of that was unavoidable, but many of those deaths could have been prevented if we had even a quasi-competent response from the federal government. And there's no question that Trump is personally directing all of this because he thought telling the truth would hurt his reelection chances. He is a murderer, and I don't say it lightly.
There was, I had this tabbed, and because I've been fumbling here trying to find this information on the study about the mask wearing. So the study comes from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but he's botching the study's findings. They did not find that 85% of mask wearers catch COVID. It found something quite different. 85% of the small group of COVID-19 patients surveyed, about 150 on the question, reported that they had worn a mask often around the time they would have become infected. The group's exposure to potentially infected people in the community varied. Most reported shopping or being at home with multiple people, but they were twice as likely to have eaten at a restaurant where masks are set aside for the meal than were uninfected people in a control group. So that is the study that I was trying to find, mm-hmm. that the president is wrongly quoting from.
I have a question for Jim, if I can.
Yes.
Joe, really quickly. The question is this. Chris Christie came out with basically an apologia about, you know, the way in which he had reacted to mask wearing and how everybody should wear it. Did you hear it? And number one, and what do you take away from his apology medically?
I didn't hear him apologize. I heard about it. I heard that he did apologize. Yeah. I didn't hear what he actually said. I was surprised that he did that. I think he should certainly have apologized. I think they all should apologize. Individuals who should be setting examples for the rest of the country, not directing us in a way that would make our lives more dangerous. But I was a little surprised to hear him apologize. I don't imagine that's anything we'll hear from the President of the United States. But
I mean, another part of that is that in that apology, he also said that he was in intensive care for over a week. I mean, that's kind of a foxhole confessional, right? I mean, it seems to me, right? He damn near died. So I guess that would change your mind.
Your foxhole is right. That's when people start to make deals with God, if you know what I mean.
Right.
If I recover, then I'll do the right thing here. And sounds that way to me.
But the right thing should be for him to convince his pal Trump to start following the science. He didn't offer to do that. And he said he was blaming the White House because he said he was told that everyone in the Amy Coney Barrett crowd was tested when in fact it was only the first three rows. He was in the third row. Well, what happens in the fourth row, Chris Christie? Mm-hmm. I mean, not exactly a brilliant analysis on his part, but I think if we want to take Chris Christie seriously, which is a hard thing to do given Bridgegate and his error, if we want to take him seriously, he should stand up and say, I'm going to do everything in my power to convince the president to turn, you know, turn in a different direction here. And he did not offer to do that.
We are very late for break, so we have to do that. Dr. Fagan, I want to thank you very much for being with us once again. It's always a pleasure and a great honor when you are before these microphones and you class up the joint, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure for me to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
All right, thank you. When we come back, we'll have a conversation with the rest of our classy members of the panel. We'll do that right after this.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you all with us. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pacitti, and Terry Gibson. So we have been talking about mostly herd immunity. It was one of the things that came out of the dueling town halls last night, President Trump and Joe Biden clashing in these events that went head-to-head. Joe Biden with George Stephanopoulos on ABC, President Trump on NBC with Today Show host Savannah Guthrie. So it was obviously they were separated. As of right now, there still is a debate scheduled for next Thursday. Both sides say they are up for it. The former Vice President Biden said at the end of the town hall with George Stephanopoulos that he does plan on being there as long as the debate commission. He's leaving up to the debate commission to make sure that it is safe and that it is being overseen. And so both sides, as of now, saying that they will be there. But let us talk about what happened last night. Alan, we'll begin with you with your thoughts.
Well, I've already had too much to say, but I want to leave it to the rest of the panel. But I do think that the outstanding moment in the debate came when the president once again said, I don't know about something. I didn't know about that. And Savannah Guthrie looked at him steely-eyed and said, yes, you do. I thought that was great.
Yeah, it was great. It was really great. Judith.
So I think it was watching the PBS NewsHour versus Worldwide Wrestling.
That's such a great analogy.
That was the split screen.
Yeah.
And I think on the fundamental issue of our time, COVID, you had a very smart, well-informed presentation by Biden showing his empathy, which I think is something the country really needs right now, versus Trump saying last night that it's, you know, on COVID, we're rounding the corner, when in fact we're not. Rates are going up. And I thought it was also interesting when Savannah Guthrie, an attorney turned broadcaster who did a great job, pressed Trump on his last negative COVID test before the most recent one. Everyone wants to know, was he infectious the first time he debated Biden? And Trump said he didn't remember if he was tested the day of the debate. That's like not remembering your wedding day or something.
Yeah.
So I think that was really telling. And I think the Biden people have to be very, very proactive in making sure that if this debate happens next Thursday, that they see documentation that Trump was that day, because I just don't trust him.
Terry Gibson.
Yeah, I thought that Joe Biden did a spectacular job. I was just impressed with his ability to stay calm and to explain his policy positions. I thought it was about as good as you could expect Joe Biden to be, considering his individual personality. He just came across as a person with great empathy and great care and great experience. And it was a drastic contrast to what you saw on the other channel. It was almost like we've just taken politics and turned it into even more so entertainment by now offering different channels that you can tune into to actually see the different candidates. I think NBC may live to regret this choice. I'm not sure it was beneficial to them and their audience. I think it may have been a big turnoff to many of their followers. And I do think that Savannah Guthrie did an excellent job. I wondered why George Stephanopoulos was the choice of the host for the Biden town hall. That to me seemed a bit odd. I would have preferred to see a woman there in that capacity. I thought that might have made for a slightly different dynamic.
Mm.
George is kind of has a history of being a Washington insider, a political player. But he did an okay job.
It doesn't answer your question, Terry. But he did the debate. He did the town hall with President Trump. So they were trying to kind of even the playing field.
He's their guy, and he's their guy.
Yeah,
he's their guy. They've invested in him, and that's what it's about. I think Terry's exactly right. It could have been somebody else. Joe, I had a question for you, or for Terry. Either of you may be able to help me with this. How do we know how many people watched either channel? How did they do that?
There are overnight ratings, and I haven't seen them yet. I assume the president will tweet them momentarily, but I do not know. I don't think they're quite out yet.
There is something out this morning on the number of people who watched it on YouTube, which is how a lot of people watch things now, and like three times more people watched Biden than Trump. So I don't think Trump will be tweeting it. Far more people tuned in for the Biden. But I think most people, in terms of your mechanical question, Alan, I think most people went back and forth and then, saw the Trump clown show and probably headed to the refrigerator for their third beer of the night watching this.
Well, I know somebody who would not turn the Trump channel on. Would not turn NBC on because she was afraid she was going to get counted.
Smart. She should have watched it on YouTube.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to talk about. We'll get everybody involved in the conversation, and we'll change topics as well. We welcome your input, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll get all to that, but first the important part, news with Ray Graff.
Oh, Lord, I wish I knew how to understand why I'm so in love with you. Nobody else in this world will do. Yeah, Daddy. Save your love for me. Broadway. If I had good sense, I'd run all the way. Oh, but like a fool. In love I stay. I'm praying you save your love for me.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 6 minutes past 10 o'clock. Alan Chartok, Judith Ann, Garen Pasitti, and Terry Gibson. with us this morning, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to those in just a moment. Senator Ben Sasse, Republican of Nebraska, castigated President Trump in a telephone town hall with constituents on Wednesday, accusing the president of bungling the response to the coronavirus pandemic, cozying up to dictators and white supremacists, and offending voters so broadly that he might cause a Republican bloodbath in the Senate. In a dire 9-minute indictment of Mr. Trump's foreign policy and what Mr. Sasse called the deficient values, his deficient values, the senator said the president had mistreated women and alienated important allies around the globe, been a profligate spender, ignored human rights, and treated the pandemic like a PR crisis. He predicted that a loss by Mr. Trump on Election Day, less than 3 weeks away, looks likely, and said that the Republicans would face steep repercussions for having backed him so staunchly over 4 tumultuous years. Now, Ben Sasse has certainly been critical of the president in the past, but this was, it seems, and I'm asking, this is a question, Alan, it seems like maybe is a migration happening here?
Well, not only that, there has to be the assumption, Joe, that maybe what's happening is they see Trump going bye-bye, and now the question is who gets online first for the next round?
Right.
Sasse may be that. Now, the other question, of course, is what's he going to do about it? In other words, is he going to vote against his Supreme Court nomination? Is he going to in any way lead the charge against the president? No, I don't think so. So this sort of is a gutless sort of thing. If you want to have courage, then you should really have courage. But you make a point, and it may well be that this is a sign of things to come.
Judith?
Well, I agree with Alan. I mean, everything Sasse said on a phone call with constituents is, of course, accurate. And it's been accurate since Donald Trump took office. So here we are before Election Day, and Ben Sasse suddenly takes some truth serum. And it's what we all know. I mean, was there anything shocking about what he shared with us? Really? But I think I want to go back to something I said last month, which is, so many of these Republicans have sold their souls to stay on the good side of Donald Trump because they were afraid of a negative tweet or not the president's good favor. And I think, you know, when the book is written, a lot of these Republicans, in fact, lose their seats anyway. You look at Cory Gardner, you look at Susan Collins, you know, Lindsey Graham is up a little bit more now in South Carolina. Now, I'm not saying that these were all, you know, champions of public interest causes in the Senate, but you sense that a bunch of them were quite uncomfortable with not only the Trump policies, but his public decorum and his, how he has ripped to shreds Democratic institutions. So I think in the end, some of these senators, it's going to be a lose-lose for them. They were capped when it mattered, and they're going to lose their seats anyway.
Terry?
Ben Sasse is in a very safe Republican seat. There's no real risk to him in coming out and being honest. There wasn't any risk to him coming out and being honest much earlier this year, like, for instance, during the impeachment hearings and all the other times he could have come out and been outspoken when it might have actually been beneficial. I'd be much more impressed if words like this came from somebody like Lindsey Graham or Susan Collins, who are actually in real competitive races. And so I don't know that it really makes a big difference other than, it, you know, it's always refreshing to see a bit of honesty come out of the Republican Party, which is a pretty rare occasion these days. But his actions do not adhere to what he's saying. He still has supported Donald Trump all the way, and I assume will continue to do so.
Aaron.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, like, Republicans didn't see this coming in 2016. Just his pre-election decorum was a pretty good indicator of what the country was in for. Maybe because it's an election year, a handful of Republicans in safe seats are really just trying to mitigate the damage they've done by saying this and perhaps, you know, inching toward Biden's good side, perhaps assuming that he's going to win. Mm. But, you know, like, it's they're trying to preserve some political capital. And, you know, every Republican who supported Trump, like Judith said, who sold their soul, really deserve everything that they have coming in terms of the potential cost to the Republican Party. So, you know, it's not a heroic statement. I don't know why this is only happening now. Trump had no clear policy for any major issue since he was elected. So, you know, this is really just hot air coming from Republicans. And the only way I can see this making sense is if they're trying to, you know, start to sidle up to Biden and having something of a strong minority in Congress.
I love Alan's point, though, that, okay, Senator Sasse, but are you gonna vote for the how are you gonna cast your vote for Judge Barrett? And obviously,
or anything else, right?
You
know, Joe, let me just interrupt for one second, if I can, and just say it's fascinating to me because we all knew during the primary, the Republican primary, they called this guy out one day after another, Lindsey Graham and everybody else. What a bunch of hypocrites! And then they got in line, but they were certainly out there and telling the truth during that time.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I was just thinking back to 2016 when Paul Ryan, they weren't sure he was going to show up at events where he would not appear with President Trump, nor would Mitch McConnell. And then, as you said, Alan, they then fell in line and then some. I'm curious, though, the question is, does anyone think that this will start to Aaron's point of started defection, where you will hear from other Republicans that have similar sentiments in a way to save their own seats?
None of them have shown evidence of having a backbone, integrity, or courage.
Right.
So unless there's, you know, a backbone is surgically implanted in Joni Ernst's back or some other senator, I don't think we're going to hear much more of this.
I don't think it's too late for that type of strategy, I think, to work. I mean, even if they come out and say something against the president, they're still registered in the wrong party. That's the problem, is that they have to appeal to the middle, and I just think it's too late to grab what's left of the middle by speaking out against Donald Trump. I think the middle probably already understands the arguments against Donald Trump. They're looking for something that I think the Republicans just can't offer because they're a Republican.
Let's all remember Joe McCarthy. And maybe we can't remember it because maybe I'm the only guy who can, age-wise. But let's remember Joe McCarthy was untouchable. You know, nobody wanted to go near him. And then, you know, drunk on his own rhetoric, he went after President Eisenhower, and that was it. And all of a sudden, some of the people came scurrying out from behind the wall. That may happen here, too.
It'll be interesting to see. How many days, Judith? What are we up to?
18 days? 18 days, but, you know, so many millions of people have already voted.
Right.
So, you know, I think I just saw a figure of 17 million.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think there's no such thing as an undecided voter over the next 18 days. I think what Trump and Biden are trying to get is people who are, whether or not, a lot of people who are just disgusted by the whole thing, which is unfortunate because there's an obvious disgust level with the two different candidates. But I think Trump wants to suppress the vote and Biden wants more people to come out. And so they're playing for that very little slice of the electorate who hasn't decided if they're going to vote yet. It's not that they haven't decided who they're going to vote for. They just may sit it out.
What scares me is that both Roselle and I voted by mail. And this is a president who we know is going to say all mail ballots should be disqualified to his friend, his new friend, which he acknowledges on the Supreme Court and the 6-3 majority. And if he gets away with that, then I haven't voted. And I'm scared to death about that.
But I think in your case by mail, Ellen, that is really controlled by the state board of elections. And your governor recently announced for Trump. And so he might just let a, you know, an honest vote count happen. I think true in Massachusetts, but not in many other states.
Okay, so what if this is a what if horrendous nightmare? What if Trump goes to the Supreme Court of the United States? We've seen federal versus state showdowns before, and says there's been massive fraud, and we hope six of you will hold up your hands and say that vote by mail doesn't count. You think this guy's beyond that, or that court is beyond it?
Oh, he's not, but I think I'm with Governor Cuomo on this one, which is Governor Cuomo has said that John Roberts and the other justices are going to decide that the integrity of the Supreme Court is more important than, you know, letting Trump steal the race. I mean, I'm still very nervous about it. And I think, you know, you're going to see just pandemonium on Election Day where Trump is telling people to show up to be, quote, poll watchers, meaning trying to intimidate voters. Yeah. I think Election Day is going to be a mess. But let's just pray it doesn't get to the Supreme Court, because I don't want to roll the dice. I'm not that hopeful that that the outcome is going to be good.
OK, Judith, so Roberts goes over to the other side. That makes it 5-4.
Right. Yep.
Yeah,
I know.
One?
No, yeah. No, I'm not counting on, maybe Gorsuch. You know, I'm certainly not counting on, still not over that one. And I'm not counting on who's probably going to be the worst, if it goes through, the worst Supreme Court justice in recent memory, Amy Coney Barrett. But Roberts and Gorsuch flipping, because they're pretty committed to the institution.
All right. So let us move on for a moment to a pair of studies that have come out about poverty. 8 million people have slipped into poverty since May, as the federal aid that was given has dried up. The studies looked at the effect of the emergency $2 trillion package known as the CARE Act and what happened when the money ran out. And the answer is not good. The number of poor people has grown by 8 million since May, according to researchers at Columbia University, after falling by 4 million at the pandemic start as a result of a $2 trillion emergency package known as the CARE Act. Using a different definition of poverty, researchers from the University of Chicago and Notre Dame found that poverty has grown by 6 million people in the past 3 months, with circumstances worsening most for Black people and children. Aaron.
Yeah, so if anything, that report's a little too rosy. And here's why. That the pandemic has been the match that's been thrown on a bunch of dry wood that's been sitting there for about four decades. The rise in income inequality in the U.S. since 1980, declining opportunity, wage stagnation, all of these things, which are structural problems, have just created the perfect opportunity for any event to kind of send 8 million people plus into poverty. So, now that, you know, 1 in 6 people live in poverty. Part of that is due, obviously, to the pandemic, but there's, I think, a broader issue, and that is how have we had four decades of economic policy that has allowed this to go on? And there is some reason for optimism because, you know, when you have crises like this, if the right people are in power, they have an opportunity to, you know, take advantage of a once-in-a-century crisis and use it to shift policy to, you know, create broader prosperity. And, you know, the CARES Act was remarkably successful in doing what it was supposed to do, and that was, you know, maintain household income levels, minimize the amount of layoffs. And when it expired in July, you just saw the complete disrespect and disregard for, you know, 90% of the economy, because there was no second round. So this is just going to further slow the recovery. Most economists now agree that the biggest risk isn't a spike in layoffs like we saw in March and April, but a slow grinding recovery that will take years, if not a full decade.
Wow.
So what does that mean for another package in the future of what that does, short-term versus long-term?
Well, if we have a Biden presidency, based on what I've heard him say and what his platform says, that, you know, the stimulus would be designed to provide income support to households and minimize the economic damage, particularly to vulnerable groups, that would help in the short term. But what we're seeing, and what Judith and I have been talking about for years at this point, is that, you know, there's an opportunity for all of these crises to converge, where an economic stimulus can address substantive issues associated with climate change. An economic stimulus can, you know, improve infrastructure and healthcare and all of these other things that are part of the overall structural problem that I was referring to. So the good news here, the silver lining, to the extent there is one, is that things have gotten so bad for so many people so rapidly that it's starting to alert a lot of individuals and politicians to the fact that this has been going on for decades. Mm-hmm. And it might be too big to ignore at this point. So there is a real opportunity. And if Trump gets reelected, then, you know, we might enter a century of like neo-feudalism. If Biden gets elected, we have a chance to develop a 21st century economy that deals with 21st century problems in a reasonable manner.
I just realized I don't think we say the word neo-feudalism enough on this program.
But Aaron, that was such
I'll try to introduce it.
Yeah, please throw that in more. Go ahead, Judith.
Such a brilliant analysis by Aaron. Everyone should just tape the last 3 minutes. That is so on point. And remember, when Obama and Biden came into office, the first big congressional accomplishment was the stimulus package. And who was in charge of making sure that money was spent effectively and efficiently? Joe Biden. So what I hope happens is stimulus one to deal with the crisis. Stimulus two, which is investments in clean electrical generation, clean transportation, all the components of a Green New Deal. I happened to land at EPA the first year of the Obama administration, and we were working, you know, very hard to push stimulus money out for drinking water improvements, improvements in sewage treatment plants. All of those needs are still there, and they will create jobs. And so this is the time, New Deal, that will affect just not job creation, but give us a fighting chance to reverse course on climate change.
Joe?
Yes, Terry.
Just to follow up on everything that was just said, the main thing we have to remember that to achieve all of these great ideas, these great goals, we absolutely, well, when I say we, I'm speaking as a member of the Democratic Party, we must absolutely win the Senate. Without a Democratic Senate, much of what has just been said will be very difficult to achieve. And of course, we must win the White House as well. So the Senate, we just can't stress enough how important this Senate race is across the country. Without them having a majority, it's going to be very difficult to get this kind of stimulus, because the Republican Party has been the ones holding this up. And remember that many of these Republican senators represent states that already have high poverty rates. Poverty is not a new concept to them, and they still have not been inspired to really do anything about it. So I'm not convinced that even this report will move them in that direction. We really have to get Democrats into these Senate seats.
And I think a perfect example of that, Terry, that is such a crucial point, is you look at the Senate race in Iowa, where it's neck and neck with Joni Ernst and Teresa Greenfield. Iowa has been devastated by the Trump administration agriculture policies and a very high COVID rate now and growing poverty. There was a crucial debate last night that I think is actually going to affect the outcome of this race. The moderator asked Teresa Greenfield, the very impressive Democrat who's running, the price of a bushel of corn, and she hit it on the nose. And then he asked Joni Ernst, the Trump sycophant, the price of soybeans, and she wasn't even close. And I think, you know, Tip O'Neill said all politics is local. An exchange like that could affect who wins the Iowa Senate seat, and that could affect who controls the Senate. There's just so much in play over the next 2 weeks.
We have a lot of letters. Go ahead, Aaron. Go ahead.
I just want to add one more thing to that, and it was something Terry said that prompted my thinking on this. One of the thing that is the of least concern right now for policymakers is the size of the deficit. The government can borrow at a 10-year interest rate of 0.73%. So anybody who can borrow money at a interest rate of 0.73% only needs to earn a rate of return that's, you know, more than 0.73%. So this is an opportunity for the government to borrow at exceptionally low interest rates to invest in the future that will allow the government to pay off that deficit at an even more rapid rate. So the size of the deficit should not be a concern. If anything, right now, the deficit's too low given the problems we face.
We just have about a minute before we have to go over to a break, and I have time for a few letters, I think. This one from Vicky, who says, I read that TikTokers and K-pop fans turned on the Biden town hall and every electronic device to drive up numbers to get inside Trump's head. We got this from Barbara. So Trump gets the virus and the miracle treatment from Regeneron. Their stock soars. Any inside trading going on? I trust nada with this president. We also go to Kevin, who says, imagine the boldness and noncompliance regarding mask wearers of Trump supporters. Should he lose the election, most are hesitant or don't follow mask and social distancing guidelines now, knowing or not that it is hurting Trump's numbers. We'll pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll go do our last go-round with this wonderful panel, and we'll be back right after this short break.
One more metaphor, one more rhyme, one more broken storyline, one more sorrowful melody, one more verse in a minor key. Wish that we had more than one more song.
I miss the panelists being in the studio, and ever since COVID hit in March, we've been all remote and we haven't been together, and which is why during this last break, I was playing with the new app that Google put out that lets you hum, and it will tell you what song is buried in your head. It's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, wow. It's like the thing with the tree. You point the camera at the tree,
yeah,
and it tells you what the
exactly.
tree is.
Exactly. And so now if you can't get the song out of your head and you don't know what it is, you just hum it to Google and Google will tell you. And that's what I was doing. I would much rather talk to you all, but that's what I ended up doing.
That actually sounds like more fun, Joe. And there's less spilling of coffee involved.
Well, you're right about the coffee, but I'm pretty sure that if I just hummed to all of you, one of you would know what was in my mind. So there you go, especially Aaron. All right, let's go to Judith. I want to talk to you for a second about another story that I just, you know, there was a moment last night during the town hall where an African American woman asked the president about the Black Lives Matter movement, to which he said there has been no president greater for African Americans since Lincoln. And I just thought, oh God. And I know I've heard him say that before, but hearing it said to an African American directly was really jarring to me. So I set that up as a way of saying that the president in his rallies is talking about he wants to be seen as a great environmentalist. And this has become a major rallying cry when he's out on the road saying that this is the environmental record that will make him a great environmentalist. The question or the statement that is made in the Washington Post headline is that could be a tough sell. Is that even a sell at all?
No, I don't think it. I don't think it passes the laugh test. I mean, I think even if you haven't read the newspaper in 4 years, you don't buy that. You just, you know, a cursory review of the record. Remember Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA, replaced by Andrew Wheeler, his previous job is he was a lobbyist for the coal industry, and it shows in Trump's policies on climate change. I mean, he has repealed well over 100 major environmental regulations, everything from clean air to and drinking water, climate change, pesticide exposures. I mean, the list of horrors goes on and on. And the really worrisome thing is the only way some of these policy reversals have been blocked was by state attorneys general like Tish James and Maura Healey and national environmental groups going to court to block these reversals. And thank God the Trump lawyers are so incompetent that they have lost most of these environmental cases. But if there's a second Trump term and you have more Trump appointees on the court, we are in big, big trouble. And if anything goes to the Supreme Court, we're doomed. You probably noticed Senator Harris questioning Judge Barrett about climate change. And she set up the question beautifully. Judge Barrett said, yes, you know, tobacco, cigarettes are a health threat. And yes, coronavirus is an infectious risk. But when asked about climate change, she would not share her views, saying it was controversial. And, you know, she's read something about it. I think it's pretty obvious by now that she's a climate denier. So people have to remember that the agency in the federal government that is sued the most is the EPA. And it's mostly sued by polluters. So
Polluters?
Yeah, by polluters. So Trump, the fossil fuel industry, the chemical industry, the whole rogues gallery of companies that are damaging our health. So Trump has already done damage to the environment in many ways. And he says this nonsensical stuff like we have crystal clean water and clean air due to his policies. And, you know, there are not enough Pinocchios to beat that back. I mean, I guess I'm not surprised that he even brings it up because he so consistently lies, but I don't think anyone's buying it. I mean, and if you are buying it, I'll just leave it at that.
Go
ahead.
Joe, I just wanted to add to that. The word environmentalist is also, I think, just a bad choice of words for this president who is trying to apparently use it to win an election. That's a loaded word when you look at it from the conservative side. They long ago put a negative connotation on the word environmentalist. So people who are environmentalists, like Judith, people who understand what environmentalist means, have a very positive connotation of that word. And they're not going to believe anything that this president says about it. People who are on the conservative side already think of environmentalists as being out of touch and illegitimate. So it's not a word that actually wins him any votes with any group. So it's a bad choice, and I think it's just a non-starter.
So it takes more than
Terry,
one.
Go ahead. I think there must be something in their private polling that has him saying this over and over again. I mean, I think what you're saying makes perfect sense, but there must be something in the polling that has him saying this. And it also gives Biden an opportunity to really, speak out more forcefully on climate change and Green New Deal. Remember, carbon emissions emitted into the atmosphere today will last for decades. So we have very, very little time to reverse course. And Biden should just take this opening. And, he's very good at pointing out how renewable energy creates jobs. When he hears climate change, he hears job opportunity. I think that's a really good message. But I also think people are really listening to Biden, particularly in the next 18 days. And he should just bring it to Trump on how his environmental record is a disaster and causes even more death and illness on top of COVID.
We have 7 minutes and a ton of letters. I'm going to go through as many as I can. Panelists.
Okay, Joe, before you,
yeah, go ahead.
Joe, before you do, as usual, we are talking about the end of mankind and womankind as we know it. And we've gotten several letters about the music on the program today. So I know you will instruct people to go to the website to find out.
WAMC.org/roundtable. And as I mentioned, it's Betty Levette from the new album Blackbirds. All right. So let's go to as many letters as we can get to. Panelists, if you want to jump in, please do. Chris says the only sensible way to look at Ben Sasse's comments is as a hedge against the possibility of Trump losing. He can claim the mantle of sensible Republican and continue to do what he's always done, work to advance the odious, unworkable, and corrupt goals of the contemporary Republican Party with or without Donald Trump. Then there is Roger, who also writes about Senator Sasse. It's reprehensible that so many of these senators have been so silent on these issues, except in private, and never called out earlier Trump's misogyny, attacking allies, supporting dictators, and support of QAnon and white supremacists, ignorance on COVID-19, and the list goes on and on. Senators should have said these things much sooner. It seems the only one who really tried was Mitt Romney, and look how the president has trashed him. The senators who were so silent for so long deserve to go down in flames. What about Dianne Feinstein hugging and praising Lindsey Graham for the Barrett hearing? She certainly did not help Graham's opponent by doing this. Also, neither of them were wearing masks. I guess no one has learned any lessons. She needs to retire or else be voted out, says Doreen. Peter writes to us and says, in my volunteer work at our state food bank, 2008 to 2018, the number of people at risk of hunger jumped from 10% of the population of Delaware to 22% of the population, approximately 50,000 people to 120,000 people in a state of 1 million souls. Kay says, I know this is off topic, but Paul Ryan is the smartest of the bunch. Disappearing was the best strategy to wait out this presidency. I find him scary, but nonetheless, I would not be surprised if he comes roaring back, especially capitalizing on the religious rights needs. We go to Debbie, who says, thank you very much for being there during these difficult times. I have family members who are in the Trump Club. They seem personally insulted at any criticism of him. I don't know whether to engage them in conversation about this election or avoid the topic and risk permanent damage to the relationship. I can't look at these people the same after hearing their ridiculous excuses and deflections.
I wrote back and said, I'm sorry.
Jill says, I think Republicans have supporting Trump because They were afraid Trump's base would vote them out or Trump would find someone to primary them at worst or humiliate them on Twitter at best. Not that the tide seems to be turning. I think it's too late for them to swim to shore at this point. To be honest, I really hope it's too late. We go to Mike. It's easy these days to lose the optimistic outlook, but today's session has taught me and reinvigorated me. If democracy does flourish in the future, it will be due to the intellect and integrity of people like those on your panel. Thank you very much. Very nice letter from Michael. We go to Aaron, not the one. Oh, I'm sorry. This is from Elias, who is writing for Aaron. Aaron, can you estimate the percentage of economists, that believe trickle-down supply-side tax breaks are meritorious?
It's probably 100% correlated with the number of economists who are not receiving money from the Koch brothers. there's still a divide on that issue because it's obviously a major issue in terms of tax and regulatory policy, but Bruce Bartlett, the founder of Supply Side Economics, has more or less disowned it at this point in that it's now just, you know, the elite hijacking the political system for their own enrichment. So the economists have a long way to go before in terms of getting behind a new type of policy. And I think there's a shift beginning in the economics profession that's starting to disavow trickle-down economics more verbally.
I hope you said shift. Okay. Ray said, could some roundtable discussion time? Well, we're out of time, so I'm actually going to skip that one. It was asking about all the positive points that Biden made, which I think we made. Judith is right. Trump is a murderer. This is Trump's shooting someone on Fifth Avenue moment, only instead of using a gun, his weapon is COVID-19. Eileen says, Dr. Fagan's shark analogy is what we need to drive the point home. An additional part of that scenario is that the people who are injured by the shark have to be cared for by our essential medical workers. More and more risk, more and more tragedy. A voting question. As you know, Mayor Alex Morse lost the primary for Massachusetts' first congressional district. Is it allowable to write him in anyway? Love your panel discussions. Well, nothing stops you from writing in anybody, right?
I think that's right.
All right.
It's always in fact, why would they give you space if you wasn't allowed?
Right. I think just bring a pen. Let's see. We have this from, good morning. I was very impressed with Biden's town hall. He's sharp, knowledgeable, humble, and introspective. He made me feel informed and hopeful. He is not a saint, just warmly human, and he sure beats the devil, says Robert. We go to another one on Biden's town hall, and this from Lynn. Peggy Lee saying, I know a little bit about a lot of things. Biden's town, it's one of the songs I sang into Google. Biden's town hall established that he knows an awful lot about a lot of things. I was bowled over at his ability to cite facts and figures on such a wide range of important issues while exuding empathy, experience, and humility. I switched to the Trump debacle in a commercial break around the time he was pretending not to know what QAnon is.
And if Biden doesn't know something, he knows who to call.
Well, and he also admits that he doesn't know and will find out. Right.
Right.
Yes, there is a difference. Okay, we are out of time. I want to thank everyone so much for being with us, all the folks who I actually got through all the letters, so that's good. I want to thank you very much for writing in to Judith and Aaron and Terry, thank you so much. Wonderful to have you and have a beautiful weekend. Alan, always wonderful to have you here. We'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend. We'll return next with the Congressional Corner.